darkness is not an affirmative force. It simply reoccupies the space vacated by the light.
This is the Hamilton Corner on American Family Radio.
It should be uncomfortable for a believer to live as a hypocrite.
Delivering people out of the bondage of mainstream media
and the philosophies of this world.
God has called you and me to be his ambassadors, even in this dark moment. Let's not miss our moment.
And now, the Hamilton Corner.
Well, good evening, America. Alex McFarland here. You're listening to the American Family Radio Network, the Hamilton Corner Show, and I've got the privilege of sitting in tonight for attorney, pastor, broadcaster Abe Hamilton III. It's my privilege to frequently sit in if Abe is on the road or traveling. And so we've got a great show tonight. In just a few moments, we're going to hear from Dr. Larry Schweikert. He's an author, historian, retired professor from the University of Dayton. And you don't want to miss this program because we're going to get some great content from Dr. Larry Schweikert. And I've admired his work for many years. But as we begin the program tonight, first of all, I want to say that it's Thanksgiving week, and I trust that you're all set for something very special. I do hope each and every one of you get to spend some time with family and loved ones. And look, all of us need to pause from our busy life and thank the Lord for all the blessings we've got, life and salvation. I hope you know Christ as your Savior. But as Americans, you know, I have to say I love this country. It's been my privilege to travel much of the world, and we are so blessed here in America. And I think we have potential for a great future, and we've got a lot to bow our heads and thank God for, and I hope you'll be very intentional and make time to do that. You know, as I was prepping for today's issues this morning and the program tonight, in the news, it says Walmart is rolling back some DEI policies and some corporate standards they had said about diversity, equity, and inclusion that they are rolling back. Also much in the news about the imposition of DEI and wokeness. There's going on the men in women's sports and transgenderism, and just a lot of things that mitigate against not only our constitutional natural law republic, but things that mitigate against common sense itself. Well, we're going to talk about this, and I want to cue this up because I've really wanted to do this for a long time. A number of years ago, I very often, when book titles catch my eye, I really want to dive in and look at the content and then the author. And I got a book some years ago, 48 Liberal Lies About American History, that you probably learned in school. And I looked into that book, and indeed, as a K through 12, and then my first undergrad degree was at a public university, I did learn a lot of liberal lies about American history, and I enjoyed that book. And then later on, I got A Patriot's History of the United States. Now, both of these books were by Dr. Larry Schweikert, who at that time was at the University of Dayton. And I became a fan of this historian, and he is with us tonight. And just in as we get towards Thanksgiving, talking about our nation, past and present, it's a great privilege to have him with us. Dr. Larry Schweikert, I want to thank you for making time to be with us tonight. And I also want to say just thank you for your work using academics to expand the knowledge base of American citizens and really contribute to the betterment of our country. So I thank you, and it's a privilege to have you on.
Well, thank you. You know, it's good to be on. And I just traveled the road I was given and kind of walked where I was shown. I made an abrupt transition to history from being a rock and roll drummer for a number of years, which we were talking about before the show a little bit. But I got a story to tell you about 48 Liberal Lies. When it came out, which is I think around 2007, 2008, something like that, I was immediately snapped up by Fox and Friends to come on every Wednesday morning for a little segment called The Trouble with Textbooks. And I'd pull out one of these lies every week. We'd talk about it for – they started me off at like 1 or 2 minutes, and finally we were ending like around 5 or 6 minutes per segment. So got to be pretty popular. Anyway, I get a call, and the guy goes, "This is Harlan Crow of Dallas, Texas." And I did a little research quickly and realized it was Trammell Crow Holdings, one of the biggest land operations in Texas, the guy who had really supported Justice Clarence Thomas. And he said, "I won't give a copy of your book to every legislator." And I thought, wow, 535 copies sold. That's awesome. He said, "No, every legislator in America." So I think this guy's nuts, right? I go, "Well, you know, that's going to cost a lot of money." And he goes, "Well, how much do you think $100,000 will get us?" And, you know, I'm silently shaking my head, on the other end of the line. So he bought 7,680 hardcover copies of that book. And over a three-day period in Dayton, Ohio, at the Montgomery County Republican Party headquarters, I signed and autographed all 7,680 copies, and we sent one to every legislator in America.
God bless you for signing all those books, and God bless him for wanting to send those out. That is really great. And, hey, just the fact that you would sign all those and help get that project done— you're a very conscientious person, and I appreciate that. Did you get any feedback from the recipients?
You know, it was really funny. We got one book returned to us from the Speaker of the House of the Kentucky legislature at the time, a Democrat, who said, "I can't accept this. This is an illegal campaign contribution."
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Well, listen, I do want to hear your story. Before we go too much farther, give your website or give us an assignment, Professor. You can do that. You're an educator, and we are learning from you tonight. So any website you want to point us to or any homework assignment you'd care to give?
Actually, yes. So my website. One is the wildworldofhistory.com, wildworldofhistory.com. And the other, if you're more politically inclined and want more of my fiery political rhetoric and so forth, is the wildworldofpolitics.com. Mm-hmm. And what we're doing on the Wild World of History is inviting people to send us an email at larry@wildworldofhistory.com and just tell us two or three of what you think are the most important events in American history, and somehow we're going to use that on the site. We already got a few in, so we're going to use it, and you know, don't worry about the writing. We'll find a way to spruce you up to make you like Shakespeare.
I've got to ask you a question. Why do liberals hate America?
You know, you, my wife, many of my best friends, you know, ask that question all the time, and I really can't help you. I mean, my go-to response is they're basically atheists, and there is a guy out there, if you don't know him, Ryan Burg, B-U-R-G-E. He has a Substack about once a week, and he delves into the religious statistics of America better than anybody I've ever seen, and he shows this very, very high correlation between Democrats and atheism, or as he calls them, the nuns, not like flying nun like Sally Fields, but N-O-N-E-S, no religion listed. And so there does seem to be a correlation between no faith in God and liberalism. I can't explain it any more than that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it seems like there's this self-loathing. And you know, Dr. Schweikert, when in the mid-80s, I was an undergrad at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, and I was not a Christian yet and didn't really know much about anything. I you know, loved the national anthem at the ball games, and I, to the knowledge degree that I had at the time, I cared about America. But I remember all my professors hated Ronald Reagan. This was the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. And it just, mm-hmm. I saw this recurrent theme. My professors hated Reagan, hated Jesse Helms, who was a North Carolina senator at that time, very conservative, hated Jerry Falwell. And it just seemed like I could predict that, look, if it was moral, religious, patriotic, I just knew my professors were going to trash it. on the other side, if it was John Lennon, the Beatles, Jim Morrison, LSD, liberal, Abby Hoffman, I knew they were going to love it. And I just thought, wait a minute here. They're all like against everything that I was raised to care about.
I had not meant to talk. I didn't mean to talk so much about the book 40 Liberal Lies, but since you mentioned that aspect, what I did when I did that book was I looked at the top 20 U.S. history college and senior high school textbooks and looked at what they had to say about these 48 different things. But I said in the, I think it's the introduction, that if you want a quick and dirty check on how reliable a textbook is, go in the index to Reagan and see what they say about Ronald Reagan. And I called it at the time the pregnancy test of a textbook, because if they got Reagan wrong, they were probably going to get many of the other things in the book wrong as well. Mm-hmm. And I think it was John Stewart, who was pretty big at the time. He thought that was pretty funny, and he took that and showed a picture of Reagan pregnant. But it is a fact that you don't have to dig through a whole textbook to find out it's biased. Go right to the Reagan section, and they'll tell you if they don't get Reagan right, they're not going to get much else right.
Now, who influenced you? Did you grow up conservative, or did through your own study? How did you arrive at the intellectual perspectives that you have and have written about so prolifically?
Well, up through high school, I don't recall anybody who really influenced me. I just kind of naturally gravitated toward Nixon in 1968, which was my first vote, and then I went on the road with several rock and roll bands and didn't pay much attention to politics for probably 8 or 9 years. And then abruptly, I came back to Phoenix and wanted to have a full-time gig where I could play rock and roll at night and do something else during the day to bring in some money.
Sure.
And I already had a degree from Arizona State in political science. And so I thought, well, I'll teach high school. That'll be an easy gig, or junior high or something like that. So when I went to get my teaching certificate, State of Arizona said, well, you're missing one thing. You've got a BA degree, but you don't have a course in U.S. history, and you must have that to teach in Arizona. So I went back to a summer school class sometime around 1976 in the summer, and my instructor was this very, very conservative Jew, not quite Orthodox, but very, very conservative. And he was rolling out names I'd never heard of, like Milton Friedman and Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek and all these people. And all of us were captivated. We had a coterie. We called ourselves Loenbergians because we followed him around and hung on his every word. It was something none of us had ever heard before. And he influenced my intellectual academic move more than anybody else ever. I mean, in a 6-week course, I decided right then and there I wanted to be a history professor.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So let me ask you this. William F. Buckley Jr., I feel like he's a name that should not be forgotten. Tell me about, first of all, what do you think he would think about Trump?
I met Buckley when he came to Santa Barbara while I was there doing my graduate work. And because I was an older student, like I said, I'd been played in rock bands for so long. And I came back, I was, you know, mid-20s, a little bit older than some of the students. And they put me in charge of the Young Republicans fundraiser. And the fundraiser was we brought William F. Buckley to Santa Barbara to give a speech.
Hey, hold that thought. Forgive me. I'm so sorry. We've got a break. Folks, great show here. We're talking with Dr. Larry Schweikert. Yeah, hold that thought. We're going to come back. I want to hear the rest of this. But this is Alex McFarland, one of the great books of our times, A Patriot's Guide to American History, so much more. TheWildWorldOfHistory.com. What a great website. What a great URL. Stay tuned. The Hamilton Corner on the American Family Radio Network is going to be back after this brief break. And on this Thanksgiving week, may God bless you. May God bless America. We'll continue learning from Dr. Larry Schweikert after this break.
A Discipleship Minute with Joseph Parker.
The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Verses 10 and 11 of John chapter 10. Jesus is the good and the great shepherd. He's the greatest shepherd there ever was. He's a shepherd that can be trusted. John chapter 12, verse 49. For I have not spoken on my own authority, but the Father who sent me gave me a command, what I should say and what I should speak. The Lord Jesus Christ himself in his earthly ministry continually trusted his heavenly Father, his great shepherd, for wisdom, for guidance and direction at every step of his life. He wasn't trying to do his own thing. He was simply trying to follow his heavenly Father. And Jesus, again, stands as a great role model for each of us.
I'm Rich Scarborough, and this is My Take. On November 5th, the American people spoke. It was a resounding victory for all conservatives and for conservative Christians in particular. The party that won stood for America's founding values and said no to abortion, no to biological men participating in women's sports and sharing locker room facilities. The party that won said no to those extreme views on the transgender issue, including government-sponsored transgender-affirming surgery for inmates, and no to an open border that's been the gateway to anyone or anything coming into America, including violent criminals, the importation of drugs, human trafficking, and more. The party that won said yes to deportation of illegal aliens, beginning with those who have criminal records. Friends, this election forced Americans to take a position for or against Judeo-Christian values and constitutional principles. I'm Rick Scarborough, and that's My Take.
Shining light into the darkness, this is the Hamilton Quarter on American Family Radio.
Folks, in all sincerity, and it's been my privilege to interview hundreds of people, many great people, but tonight is something I've thought about for a long time, to interview Dr. Larry Schweikert, PhD from UC Santa Barbara, professor of history, University of Dayton. He was queuing up a story about meeting William F. Buckley, and I want him to finish that. So, Dr. Schweikert, first of all, thank you so much for being with us tonight, and thank you for the body of work you've created. In utter sincerity, I am deeply grateful for the work you've done, and I'm one of the beneficiaries of it. But I want you to finish. You were with the Young Republicans, and you brought William F. Buckley Jr. to your campus. Tell us that story, if you would.
So I was put in charge of the club to bring him in, and he is an amazing, or was an amazing, piano player.
Really?
We put him up at, there were some very wealthy people, and said, oh, we have a guest house, and we'll put him in our guest house. Well, so we take him over to the house, and he sees a grand piano in there, and he immediately sits down, just starts to play incredible music, which is, this is how I relieve tension, as I just play this. But he told me something I always kept with me, and this is advice I give to everybody who wants to be a writer of any sort, historian, but any kind of writer. And I said, how do you write so much? Because you write a column at least once a week for National Review, sometimes a couple. You're the editor of National Review, but you also have your novel series of Blackford Oaks, was kind of a secret agent that he invented and wrote numerous novels. And he said, well, you know, I get up in the morning. Now, this is, remember, this is in the 80s. As I get up in the morning, I brush my teeth, and I sit down at the typewriter. And I thought that was the best advice I ever heard for writers. If you want to be a writer, you must write. You must write everything. I wrote music reviews for a hippie newspaper here in Phoenix, which allowed me to go see Led Zeppelin. Free. It was a horrible concert. I couldn't believe how bad they were. I wrote.
Plus, they plagiarized a lot of people.
Well, it was just that they were so drugged out and drunk that night. It was just a terrible concert. I wrote editorials on this, that, and everything. So the point is, if you want to write, and that's going to be more or less your profession, you need to write all the time. If you're a golfer, you play golf all the time, right? Mm-hmm. So I thought that was very important advice from him. And we had a great evening. And what would he think of Trump? William F. Buckley was a patrician, and he was of the upper class and the elites, even though he famously said he'd rather be governed by the first 500 names in the Boston phone book than by the Harvard faculty. He personally was a patrician elite, and he was still smart enough, I think, to understand not only Trump's appeal, but the necessity of a Donald Trump in today's politics. Ronald Reagan probably couldn't get elected today because of his style and his approach. We're in a much coarser period, and many of the niceties and the fineries that someone like Reagan and Bill Buckley observed are not available anymore. What you may regret that, but they just aren't. That's the reality of modern politics, and Trump is. And so Trump is to today what Lincoln was in his day, what FDR was in his day, and what Reagan was in his day.
By the way, this is fascinating, and I feel very privileged to glean your experiences because you've been around long enough to watch the trajectory not only of American politics but of American conservatism in the last, 40 years. Before we forget William F. Buckley, it's interesting, and folks, I encourage you, go online and watch old episodes of Firing Line, which was the show Buckley had on NPR, because, first of all, they were an hour long, and they would delve into really deep conversation. The atheist, Christopher Hitchens, whom I debated on several occasions, and I interviewed him on several occasions, but Buckley would have on somebody that was an ideological, opposite, like an atheist, like, Hitchens. But yet they would have very in-depth, respectful discourse back and forth. And all of that to say this, nowadays we're so soundbite driven and everything seems kind of like hyper ADD. Do you think a show like Firing Line could exist today, or could a slow, well-spoken patrician like William F. Buckley Jr., would he have a platform if he were coming on the scene in 2024?
Well, the answer to the first question is yes, we have those. They're called Joe Rogan podcasts. We have long-form interviews all over the web. And some of them are fairly well-spoken, erudite, slower, but that's just not modern culture, and it's going to be harder to attract an audience anymore. And the reality today is that you need to attract an audience to stay on the air. Buckley, it was interesting. I learned this from him, and it surprised me. We got to talking about why he did speeches, and he says, "I do the speeches to keep National Review in publication because we would never make it if we had to rely on subscriptions and donors."
Wow. Is National Review ideologically, or are they still today true to his vision, do you think?
I don't know what they're true to. They lost almost every conservative principle when Trump was in office the first time, because whatever Trump was for, including all those things that were conservative, whether it was restricting abortion or whether it was voter integrity or whether it was to stay out of foreign wars, they were against. Mm-hmm. And they have sold themselves out so badly today, I think Buckley probably would have resigned from the organization.
Yeah. That's a whole other subject. And, I'd love to talk in depth on the current state of National Review, but I want to go to some other things. No, I'm here. Can you hear me? Are you there? Hey, Doctor.
I'm not hearing you. I think I lost you.
Uh-oh. Well, I hope you can hear me. Let me communicate with my producer here and make sure that we're still on. Okay, Dr. Schweikert, let's try to get him back because it apparently we've got a little connection problem there. Alex McFarland here. I'm going to read a quote, and hopefully we'll get Dr. Schweikert back on. But this is a great quote from one of his books. He says this, quote, "So many left-wing historians fail to understand what every colonial settler and every Western pioneer understood. Character was tied to liberty and liberty to property. And the surest way to ensure the good presence of character was to keep God at the center of one's life, community, and ultimately the nation." Quote, now listen to this, Larry Schweikert. He says, quote, "Separation of church and state meant freedom to worship, not freedom from worship. It went back to that link between liberty and responsibility, and no one could be taken seriously who was not responsible to God." End of quote. Now, I realize that's a mouthful, but that is very, very profound. Really, I mean, accountability to others, accountability to parents, honesty, character, morality, all of those things flow from being accountable to God, realizing that we're going to answer for the life we live. And, you know, earlier in the interview, Dr. Schweikert was saying that, you know, Democrats, not all, but many, maybe even most, skew secular. Many, many, many are atheists, don't really believe in God. And if you don't believe in God, you don't really believe in ultimate truth. And if you don't really believe in God, you certainly don't really feel like you're accountable to God. And yet, from the very beginning, yeah, I think about this. John Quincy Adams, our sixth president, July 4th, 1837, he was giving a speech. And he said that our government was, quote, built on the Redeemer's mission. And so many of our founders, they would articulate the fact that we are accountable to God. And as George Washington said, religion and morality are the pillars on which our nation stands. Hey, without those pillars, conversely, without religion, and by the way, in religion, they meant Christianity overwhelmingly. Even Christopher Hitchens, the atheist, he says this in his book on Thomas Jefferson, that we were built as a Christian nation. Tell you what I'm going to do, since apparently we lost our guest. Or is he back? Do we have Dr. Schweikert? Are you back?
I'm back.
Praise God. I don't know what happened, but we lost you there for a moment. Did you hear the quote I read?
Well, yeah, I heard you talking about the pillars, and it's interesting that in Patriots' history of the United States, we developed the four pillars of American exceptionalism, which we found no other nation, not just in the world today, but no other nation in human history has been built on these four pillars. And the first one was a Christian, mostly Protestant, religious tradition. And the reason that's so important is because it started the country off with a bottom-up church governance of congregationalism. And no other nation in the world has ever had a religion that was bottom-up, that is, not top-down like a pope or a patriarch or, you know, the King of England, who's the head of the Anglican Church. And so when you combine that with the second pillar, which was common law, which was a bottom-up political system, right then and there, the United States started off with a foundation that was unheard of in human history, which
unique.
Was bottom-up religion coming from the people and bottom-up governance coming from the people.
Mm-hmm. Pillars 3 and 4, what are they?
Private property with written titles and deeds, very important because there's still parts of the world that don't have that today, and free market economy.
You know, it's interesting. Every time the government, you know, inserts itself into the free market economy, the results are bad. And we could talk about that. But pillar number two, common law. Now, I want to make sure I understand. Is this also synonymous with natural law, like when Jefferson wrote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." Would you explain in a little more for us common law? What is meant by that?
Sure. Common law came over to the English from the Germanic tribes, and it was the notion that God, or in their case, the gods, put the law in the hearts of the people, and that the people would elect or select rulers who would carry out or enforce that law. Well, it turns out this is found both in the Old and in the New Testament, where God said he would write his laws on the hearts of the people, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have a bottom-up concept that laws are to be developed by what the people already know and understand, and the rulers are there merely to be functionaries of the people, not to dictate downward. And at the time, virtually all of Europe and all the rest of the world was top-down, divine right of kings, mm-hmm. that said God put the law in the hands of the king, and he dispensed it downward. What's interesting is that later was taken over by Napoleon, 1800 to about 1814, and he codified those laws in something called the Code Napoleon, or civil law, that said that, again, the ruler hands the law down from the top. Napoleon spread that throughout all of Europe as he conquered all of Europe, even though he eventually came to defeat. And so most of Europe, if not all of Europe, has civil law, whether it's Germany, Italy, Spain, or whatnot. And so at their heart, they believe in top-down governance. But what's really interesting is that also followed the English colonies when the English and the Europeans began to colonize and conquer much of the rest of the globe. The Europeans took civil law with them. The English, you would have thought, would have taken common law with them, but they didn't. They governed their colonies through the dominion process, in which it was top down. So virtually the rest of the world that was colonized by the Europeans was colonized with an idea of top-down governance. So what's the implications for us today? Well, how many of your listeners out there during the COVID, the China virus as I call it, looked at Australia or Canada and said, I don't get it. Why are they so tyrannical? Aren't they democracies? And the answer is, yes, they're democracies, but they come from a heritage of top-down governance, not bottom-up, that rebels against tyranny. And so they went along with it, you know, like sheep.
Do you have hope that, with the most recent election and just the red wave, that a bottom-up government of the people, by the people, with the consent of the governed, is that coming back?
Well, it's pretty clear that bottom-up worked in this election for president. It's not quite so clear that it worked in other parts. So we're kind of drifting into political analysis here, but my thought on the election was, by the way, for your listeners, I said in June on Twitter and many other places that Trump had already won the election based on the fundamentals and where everything was.
Hold that thought. I'm so sorry. We've got a break. Stay tuned, folks. Oh. More, and we'll open up the phones for your calls with Dr. Larry Schweikert. Don't go away.
The American Family Association's mission is to inform, equip, and activate individuals to strengthen the moral foundations of our culture. We also support the church. Our goal is to be a leading organization in biblical worldview training or cultural transformation. AFA believes that all men and women, whether in private or public, should be free to exercise their faith without hindrance from the government.
Thank you for standing with the American Family Association.
It was a bad move. Target invited men who say they feel like women into restrooms and changing areas designated for women. They probably guessed other retailers would follow their lead, but they were wrong. Others saw that bandwagon was headed in the wrong direction. We're not ready to sacrifice the safety of women and children for the sake of progressive bathroom policies. Invite Target to make a better move. Sign the Boycott Target Pledge at AFA.net.
Trump presidency in the world order. This is David Wheaton, host of The Christian Worldview. Geopolitical analyst Soren Kern writes in the December issue of The Christian Worldview Journal that a Donald Trump presidency is likely to have a major effect on the global order. America's feckless foreign policy the past 4 years of the Biden administration diminished our standing in the world, including the humiliating withdrawal from Afghanistan and woke ideologies in our military. The Bible says that in treaties and prayers, petitions and thanksgivings be made for kings and all who are in authority, so that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity. Pray for President Trump that he leads in a far better way. Hear our most recent program with Soren Kern at thechristianworldview.org and then tune in this weekend for a special Thanksgiving program.
Listen to The Christian Worldview with David Wheaton, Saturday mornings at 8 Central on American Family Radio.
The Hamilton Quarter podcast and one-minute commentaries are available at AFR.net. Back to the Hamilton Quarter on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the program, A Patriot's History of the United States, from Columbus's Great Discovery to the War on Terror. Dr. Leary Schweikert, an author, I highly recommend his website. I want to make sure I get it correct. Dr. Schweikert, what is that? TheWildWorldOfHistory.com?
Yes, WildWorldOfHistory.com. For history, we have a VIP subscription where you can get all sorts of lessons in history outside of our curriculum, about 50 or 60 hours worth of video lessons on everything from the Charge of the Winged Hussars to was Prohibition popular. And then we have a full curriculum in U.S. history, mostly for homeschoolers, but for any educator, for high school. And I teach every chapter of Patriot's History of the United States in video. So check that out. Also, if people want to email me at Larry@wildworldofhistory.com, I've written a new chapter 23 for Patriot's History of the United States, the 15th anniversary edition, and that covers the years 2018 to 2023, and I'll give it to you free. It's a PDF, so just email me at Larry@wildworldhistory.com and say, hey, give me the new updated chapter of Patriot's History.
Wow, that's very gracious of you. And by the way, the number, folks, is 888-589-8840. That's 888-589-8840. If you have a question, rare opportunity to ask a question of, I feel like, one of the great intellectuals of our time, Dr. Leary Schweikert. And we're going to take a call from Texas right now. Virginia in Texas, thanks for holding and welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much, Alex and Dr. Schweikert. It's such an honor to speak with both of you. Dr. Schweikert, I read your Patriot's History several years ago, and I just loved it. I learned so much. And the reason I wanted to call in tonight was one thing that I learned that still a lot of people are confused about was what was the real reason for the Civil War. And you explain that so well. And I tell people to this day, I said, the Civil War was fought over slavery. It had nothing to do with economics and all that stuff. Slavery was the issue, and President Lincoln rose to that challenge. He gave his life for it, like a lot of other brave men did as well. But I thank you for that.
Mm. Well, thank you. The whole slavery story is so interesting because it really creates the modern-day Democrat Party. Martin Van Buren, a New York state congressman like Thomas Jefferson, was so afraid that the slavery issue was going to cause a civil war in the 1820s. He devised a brand new political party to try to avoid that. And the party was run on the basis of spoil system or patronage, which unfortunately meant that with every election, the government was destined to grow. So from the 1820s on, again, because of good intentions, the die was set where it didn't matter who was in charge. In order to get elected, you had to give away jobs to get elected, and that was going to cause government to grow. And then you get to the second part of that, which is that Once the Louisiana Purchase territories were opened up for settlement, the Missouri Compromise stated that everything above the 3630 line was going to be free soil. And that meant within a short matter of time, the southern states were going to be not just outvoted on slavery, but badly outvoted on slavery, and that sooner or later you're going to get legislative abolition of slavery, legislative emancipation. And that's why the war over the territories, everything from the Kansas-Nebraska Act to the Dred Scott case, everything focused on the territories, because once you admitted slavery into the territories, it was going to get back into the free states. You couldn't keep it out. Mm. But if you prohibited slavery in the Louisiana Purchase territories, sooner or later that logic was going to be applied to the slave South, and you wouldn't be able to keep that out. So it really was a battle that was going to end in the abolition of slavery, either peacefully or by war, and both sides knew it.
Mm. Do you feel, by the way, Virginia, thank you for that great question. And let me ask you this, Dr. Schweikert. And by the way, folks, if you have a question, we have time for probably a couple of calls. And the number is 888-589-8840. Virginia, are you still on? Virginia? We've lost her. Let me ask you this. What, for the average American, what do you feel like would be the most important thing that they need to know and really internalize about our nation to, you know, help people accurately understand what America is?
Well, it's really three documents, and it's the Mayflower Compact that is our first governing document that set up. First of all, they pledged their allegiance to King George. They said, we're not trying to be rebels because we landed in the wrong spot. And second of all, they said, we're a nation of, they didn't believe in the nation then, but we're a colony of equality, because half of the members on the Mayflower were not pilgrims. They were not Puritans. And then the third thing was, we believe in electing our own governor, and they elected John Carver as their governor. I mean, that's common law right there. Second document, of course, would be the Declaration of Independence, which must always be read in conjunction with the Constitution, because as Lincoln pointed out, you can't have the Constitution if it is not dedicated to a proposition, and that proposition was that all men are created equal in the Declaration. So when you tie those three documents together, you can see from 1600 really to the Civil War a very straight line that ties people from God to a democratic republic to a constitutional republic with rights.
Well, and, you know, I'm glad that you make the connection between the Declaration and the Constitution, but I would urge people, please, very carefully and thoughtfully read the preamble. Because don't you feel like the preamble to the Constitution is just genius?
Well, right. This is what we are trying to achieve when we write down these ordinances, these laws that are going to govern us from here on out. By the way, I did with Ralph Reed, and again, if people want to email me, I can give you a link, but we did a whole series on America's founding, and we would each take turns reading various documents, and I read and explained the Declaration and the Articles of Confederation and a couple of the Articles of the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights in video. So, again, people want to get a hold of me at Larry at Wild World of History or through the wildworldhistory.com. We can set you up with some of those free videos.
We're going to go to Ohio. Dwayne in Ohio, welcome to our conversation with Dr. Larry Schweikert.
Well, good evening, gentlemen. But the professor is wrong about William F. Buckley. Buckley, okay, in his later career, betrayed the conservative movement. There's an author by the name of Paul Gottfried, a Jewish author, and is now a professor emeritus of a small university. not an Ivy League, but smart guy. I think he's about 88 years old now.
How do you feel like Buckley betrayed conservatism?
Well, he gave in to the neoconservatives, and that was it's detailed in the book called The Great Purge, The Deformation of the Conservative Movement. And it's about how Buckley gave in to people like Harry Jaffa and Irving Kristol, and had the purge refers to the firing of a lot of senior editors of National Review at the time. But early in his career, when which Buckley was famous for saying at the masthead of the National Review to stand athwart history, saying stop, it became a squeak, and the older Buckley was more concerned about his personal vanity than he was about the movement itself.
Dr. Schweikert, what do you say?
Well, I know Gottfried, and of course we were frequent writers on a journal that came out from Young America's Foundation called Continuity back in the day. Yeah, Bill, of course, had some neocon streaks. I'm not sure I would call that a betrayal at all. The conservative movement is a pretty big tent and is getting bigger every day, which is one of the reasons so many of the old vine rhinos want out or want to stop it, is they don't like many of their new neighbors who are white, blue-collar people. So I just have to differ with you on that. But like I said, Paul and I can debate that on many occasions.
Mm. Thanks, Dwayne. Kevin from Arkansas. Kevin, thanks for holding. Welcome to the American Family Radio Network.
Greetings and blessings all around. Okay, my question is about common law. Years back in the 80s, I was studying and come across common law, or old English common law, that most of the states were using. The exceptions were Louisiana was under Napoleonic law and Texas under Spanish law. But I kept looking for a copy, old English common law, and I couldn't find one, and I came to the decision that it wasn't a written law, that's why it was called common law. Is that true, or is there some sort of writing that lays out old English common law?
No, you're very perceptive, and the English system is to allow citizens through lawsuits to challenge various laws and so forth. And the common law becomes whatever the judges have ruled over the years on those citizen brought cases. By the way, though, of course, the founding document of common law for our system is the Magna Carta. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, have you ever seen the Magna Carta?
I haven't.
I haven't read it, but I know about it.
No, not read it. Have you seen the actual Magna Carta? It toured America about, I don't know, 25, 30 years ago. And it's mouse print. I don't know how anybody could read it, let alone write it. It's you need a photon microscope to read how incredibly small the print is on that thing. But that was your basic group of nobles. Yeah, they were not common everyday people, but they were common compared to the king, saying that you have promised us, you've made a covenant with us about all of these rights to land ownership, and we're going to hold you to it. Now, of course, later kings violated that, and people will always break covenants. We're not God, after all. But nevertheless, it was a great statement of the fact that the law was coming from the bottom up, from lower levels to the king.
Very interesting. Thank you so much.
Yes, and
sure,
you know, Dr. Schweikert, I mean, in the Declaration, Jefferson refers to self-evident truth. He says we all these truths to be self-evident. And you know, the founders would speak of the laws of nature and nature's God. I, in my own personal, you know, journey, begin to study natural law, Which, by the way, whenever if I'm at a university doing Q&A and I talk about moral truth, very often students or professors, they'll say, oh, but the non-establishment clause of the First Amendment prohibits the imposition of objective morality. Do you think, am I right? And feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. It's important to help people understand there's a difference between religion and morality. And I feel like the non-establishment clause of the First Amendment has been extrapolated to mean the abolition of all moral boundaries. And that's something that's great, you know, danger to our country. There is a difference between religion and morality, isn't there?
Well, yeah, of course there is. But the non-establishment clause refers to the federal government. It makes no statement on what states could do. And at the time, many states were still paying ministers. And when Jefferson said that, some states are still paying ministers to be agents of the state church. The founders fully expected it to be within the rights of, let's say, Utah to have a Mormon religion in Utah, or for Pennsylvania to have a Quaker religion in Pennsylvania. They wouldn't have found that to be at all weird. And I have to say one other thing across my mind, because your caller, I think, the guy who
I am so sorry. I beg your forgiveness. We're almost out of time. Dr. Schweikert, thank you. We've got to do this again. Happy Thanksgiving to you and yours. To everybody, thanks for listening. May God bless you, and may God bless America.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.